The Ark of Millions of Years, Chapter 19, The Brave New World. There were survivors of the 9600-9500 BC cataclysm. However, the topography, time, and climate had all changed. Previous to the cataclysm was a period often referred to as the Golden Age. The Earth then had a near vertical axis. This axis made practically all of Earth's landmass temperate, mostly tropical. The exception was a few areas in the polar regions where it might have been cold enough for some icing. Hot and cold climate temperatures were unknown, and day and night were equally divided. However, they may have been longer due to a slower rotation of the Earth. Perhaps 30 hours as opposed to 24 today. Biological evidence shows a remarkable proliferation of plant and animal life. Vegetation was richer and more abundant than that of today. Mountains were lower and seas shallower. Earth was a virtual paradise. Allen and Dallaire state in their book, When the Earth Nearly Died, the following. Studies have shown that at 10,178 BC, or over 12,000 years ago, the celestial pole was inclined at an angle of 30 degrees from its present position. This, in turn, strongly suggests that the terrestrial axis was then oriented differently from today. It also suggests that at the time of the deluge, which allegedly terminated the Golden Age, there must have been a change to the tilt of the Earth's axis. Any axial changes of the type just suggested would, of course, have been attended by various other major natural adjustments on quite literally a global basis. It is also clear that the loss of this ancestral paradise involved a rearrangement of the seasons. Indeed, describing the world before the present, the Navajo Indians of North America insist that the seasons were much shorter than they are now. A year then was but a month of our time. The elder gods, or Nephilim, were forewarned by their seer stones of the impending disaster coming from an errant interloper on collision course with planet Earth. They foresaw the event by nearly 1,000 years of their time then. They immediately took measures to preserve some of the Earth's population from complete annihilation. Underground cities were dug out in various parts of the world to save part of the population. Besides having the ability to see into the future, they could discern what areas were the most survivable. In 1964, in eastern Turkey, near Kaymakli, such an underground tenement was discovered with several levels and corridors, 10 feet wide and 6.5 feet high. Huge round stones, similar to millstones that could be locked from the inside, closed doorways. Beneath the town of Dirinkuyu, another underground city was discovered that had 8 stories and was big enough to hold a population of 20,000. This underground tenement was completely invisible from the ground, in spite of ventilation shafts. These dugout cities are believed to date back before 10,000 BC. These are 2 of the 36 and possibly 40 underground cities of Cappadocia. Not all have been explored due to cave-ins. A few are open to the public. Another colonizing branch of the Atlanteans arrived in North Africa prior to the cataclysm and populated the Triton Sea's rim and some of its islands, referred to in the histories of Herodotus. One large island had centrally located low-lying mountains, shaped like a trident, the symbol of Neptune's Atlantis, and their homeland. This colony of Atlanteans called themselves the Tuaregs. They hollowed out these mountains to establish libraries for their sacred texts, a safe haven, and place for their sacred temple rites. Another range of mountains located in their rim territories were the Atlas Mountains, named after Atlas, one of the sons of Neptune. It is said that the giant Hercules, son of the Olympic god Zeus and Alcmente, helped the Tuaregs build a second set of underground tenements in this mountain range. No doubt the Tuaregs rode out the cataclysm in these underground safe havens, having been forewarned by the gods. After the cataclysm that sunk Atlantis, the Triton Sea was drained, and their island low-lying mountain range had risen to towering mountains, which became part of the Ahaggar mountain range of southern Algeria. In time, the area around North Africa became an arid desert known as the Sahara. The descendants of the Tuaregs are known today as the Tuaregs, who are the nomadic Berber traders of the Sahara. Tourists are permitted today to visit the underground caverns of Ahaggar Mountains and experience for themselves the intact remains of an Atlantean civilization. Visitors are even allowed to tour the Tuareg underground library, whose shelves are packed with thousands of ancient texts, some dating back to the time of Atlantis. Intricate tunnel systems with cavernous crypts connected the major Andean cities and temple sites, previously discussed in another chapter. These tunnel systems ran hundreds of miles through Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia, some which have been partly explored. Legends speak of a Pan-American system of tunnels that once connected all the Americas, terminating in the Arizona desert. Besides being used as an underground highway, the tunnels afforded protection and safe havens for their treasures, maps, and sacred written records. In Eric von Daniken's book, The Gold of the Gods, von Daniken and archaeologist Juan Moriz, an Argentine subject, explored a hidden tunnel system in Ecuador in 1969, which is guarded by hostile Indians. The tunnel system is situated within the triangle formed by the three towns, Gualaquiza, San Antonio, and Yaupi, which are located in the province of Morona-Santiago. Von Daniken states in his book, "My doubts about the existence of the underground tunnels vanished as if by magic, and I felt tremendously happy." Maurice said that passages like those through which we were going extended for hundreds of miles under the soil of Ecuador and Peru. As they were exploring the tunnels, they entered into a gigantic hall full of statues of animals and the most precious treasure of all, a metal library. Von Daniken writes, "The library of metal plaques was opposite the zoo, to the left of the conference table. It consisted partly of actual plaques and partly of metal leaves, only millimeters thick. Most of them measured about 3 feet 2 inches by 1 foot 7 inches. After a long and critical examination, I still could not make out what material had been used in their manufacture. It must have been unusual, for the leaves stood upright without buckling in spite of their size and thinness. They were placed next to each other like bound pages of giant folios. Each leaf had writing on it, stamped and printed regularly as if by a machine. So far, Maurice has not managed to count the pages of his metal library, but I accept his estimate that there might be 2,000 or 3,000. Von Daniken further states that the characters on the metal plaques are unknown. Maurice felt these metal plaques might contain a resume of the history of a lost civilization. Maurice later went and claimed a title deed on the caves inside Ecuador on July 21, 1969, and put them under state control, which will smooth the way for future research. The title deed makes him the legal owner of the metal library and other objects in accordance with Article 665 of the Civil Code. His request for an audience with the President of Ecuador was met with long delays that apparently never materialized. It appears that President Velasco Ibarra, had no time to give to an unknown archaeologist with tales of an incredible discovery. Apparently, these tunnels do exist. In 1973, a British group of explorers partially explored some of the tunnels. No mention was made of any artifacts found. Chinese and Tibetan legends contend that most all ancient Asian cities were once connected by a network of underground passages and caverns, which ran under the entire continent. Colonizers from Mu were said to have taken protection from certain destruction in these subterranean caves from an impending disaster and deluge. Some of these tunnels terminate in Tibetan monasteries. The cave temples of Tunghung in western China and Ellore in Ahante in India. The Egyptians had a vast network of underground tunnels and caverns that connected the pyramids with their temples. In addition, they had numerous catacombs and subterranean crypts of vast extent in Thebes and Memphis that were used as safe havens, burials, and sacred rites. It is now known that the entire Giza Plateau is honeycombed with underground tunnels. It is conceivable that the Sphinx was constructed hurriedly by the gods before the cataclysm to mark the site of the Hall of Records. Knowledge was important to the elder gods, and it was urgent to preserve their records for the future in a safe place. It is said that the god Thoth, Hermes of Atlantis, recorded vital information on emerald tablets and deposited them in the Hall of Records before the deluge. The Giza site marks a powerful vortex and therefore would be easy to find should the Sphinx fail to survive the impending disaster. Some survive by being on high ground or mountaintops. Most all claim to have had divine warning in advance by the gods. The following is an extract from When the Earth Nearly Died. In the well-known Greek story of Philemon and Baucis, for example, the righteous Phrygian couple were taken by the gods Zeus and Hermes to the top of a lofty mountain to escape the fate reserved for their fellow men, perished shortly afterwards in a deluge. The Chinese relate a similar story of Maligasima. That sounds a whole lot like Atlantis, as follows. The continent, which legend relates formerly sank beneath the ocean's waves, as related in a legend owing to the iniquity of the giants. In Maligasima, it was submerged with all its inhabitants, except the king, Piriran, who was able to escape from the deluge with his family, having been warned by the gods of the impending disaster. Through two idols, the king and his descendants peopled China. From Judd's Atlantis, Mother of Empires, the Hindu Bhagavata Purana tells us that the fish god who warned Satyravata of the coming of the flood directed him to place the sacred scriptures in a safe place. In Berosus' version of the Chaldean flood, he says, the deity Kronos warned him that there would be a flood by which mankind would be destroyed. He therefore enjoined him to write a history of the beginning, procedure, and conclusion of all things and bury. Others survived by building boats, arks, in advance by divine warnings. Others, not listening to warnings, grabbed whatever floating object they could and hung on for dear life. These being the true deluge heroes in many legends. Worldwide are legends of refugees and animals becoming entombed in caves with their entrances blocked with mud, boulders, and rocks borne by the floodwaters. Survivors had to literally dig their way out to the surface. It is obvious that deep caverns would not afford protection from rampaging floodwaters unless located high in mountain places, even when most were death traps. Of the shockingly low number of humans who survived, almost all lived in higher altitudes of mountain ranges or purposefully took shelters there in caves. The cataclysm of 9600-9500 BC was known traditionally as the flood of Deucalion. The flood of Noah was called the flood of Ogyges. On the temporal earth, the flood of Deucalion occurred before the flood of Ogyges. However, they really occurred at the same time. Remember, the spirit earth was in another time and dimension when the flood of Ogyges occurred. Both creations were experiencing destructions at the same time, but one creation was in another dimension. Allen and Dallaire state, Commons Beaumont Appian Way is emphatic on this point. Tatian, Clement, and Eusebius all agree that the Phaeton event, the cataclysm, was identical with the Deucalion flood. Now, your authors think differently on the names of the two floods. We believe that Tatian, Clement, and Eusebius did not know about the union of the two earths and have confused, as many have, the cataclysm with the flood of Noah. We believe that the Egyptian Gnostics had it correct with the following statement found in the Apocalypse of Adam. And God will say to Noah, whom the generations will call Deucalion. It now appears that the cataclysm was the flood of Ogyges, and the flood of Noah was the flood of Deucalion. We felt it necessary to present both documented views because scholars of the above texts would have called us to task. The names of the two floods and when they occurred have long confused writers, both ancient and modern. Allen and Dallaire further state, the Earth's rate of spin was probably the single most important factor which determined its survival as a planet. Earth's slower rotational rate, preventing it from breaking up, although not in our submission by any great margin, Earth's survival apparently came close to a situation best described as touch and go. Legends worldwide speak of survivors, but the real test of survival was yet to come. Following the catastrophe, the Earth was plunged into darkness, ensued with unbearable cold that endured for years after the floodwaters had subsided. This period has traditionally remembered as the Age of Darkness. Numerous accounts speak of a collapsed sky condition, where people could not stand upright without literally touching the low firmament. Several African tribes share a belief of ancient times when the god Kagra threw the firmament upon the earth to annihilate humanity. The following is from the Huainanzi writings of Chinese Prince Huainan. Nuwa melts the sky. Nuwa mends the sky. In ancient times, the four corners of the sky collapsed, and the world with its nine regions split open. The sky could not cover all the things under it, nor could the earth carry all things on it. A great fire raged, and would not die out. A fierce flood raced about and could not be checked. Savage beasts devoured innocent people. Vicious birds preyed on the weak and old. Then Nuwa melted rocks of five colors and used them to mend the cracks in the sky. She supported the four corners of the sky with the legs she had cut off from a giant turtle. She killed the black dragon to save the people of Jizhou, the region, central region of the nine regions, and blocked the flood with the ashes of reeds. Thus the sky was mended, its four corners lifted, the flood tamed, Jizhou pacified, and harmful birds and beasts killed, and the innocent people were able to live on the square earth under the dome of the sky. It was a time when birds, beasts, insects, and snakes no longer used their claws or teeth or poisonous stings, for they did not want to catch or eat weaker things. Nuwa's deeds benefited the heavens above and the earth below. Her name was remembered by later generations, and her light shone on every creation. Now she was traveling on a thunder chariot, drawn by a two-winged dragon and two green hornless dragons, with auspicious objects in her hands and a special mattress underneath, surrounded by golden clouds, a white dragon leading the way and a flying snake following behind. Floating freely over the clouds, she took ghosts and gods to the ninth heaven and had an audience with the heavenly emperor at Lin Men, the place where the heavenly gods lived, where she rested in peace and dignity under the emperor. She never boasted of her achievements, nor did she try to win any renown. She wanted to conceal her virtues in line with the ways of the universe. It is impossible to calculate just how many beings, including perhaps some giant offspring, survived the actual event of the cataclysm, but probably more than half of the survivors died from exposure to the terrible cold, without proper clothing, lack of fresh food, and, in general, hellish living conditions. Men were reduced to living like beasts, having to eat the frozen flesh of dead animal carcasses. Some probably practiced cannibalism, a practice that remains prevalent, particularly in South America and the South Pacific Islands, until the early part of the last century. Only the strongest managed to survive. At that time, the future of mankind was unquestionably hanging in the balance. Humankind had been literally catapulted into a new age of uncertainty. It was adapt or perish. It was the end of the Golden Age, first time, or Zeptepi, as called by the ancient Egyptians and the fourth sun. Another excerpt from When the Earth Nearly Died states, "The ancient association of a period of intense cold on Earth with some celestial influence is also found in the Old Testament, which links the icy phase with the Pleiades and with Maseroth, alias Phaeton or Marduk. For we read, out of whose womb came forth the ice and the hoary frost of heaven, who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his seat?" In spite of overwhelming circumstances, mankind did adapt in a most marvelous way. They banded together in tribes, pooling and utilizing their talents and resources. They migrated to warmer latitudes, where the collapsed sky condition was less pronounced, and to areas where the landscape had proceeded with revegetation. DNA studies have shown that around the time of the cataclysm there was a bottleneck effect, meaning a sudden catastrophic decrease in population, and shortly afterwards, influx of migration into different parts of the world. Indeed, it was a different world. The topography of the entire globe had changed. The new inclined axis of the now wobbling, unstable Earth caused severe weather conditions. Coastlines had changed. Tall mountains had risen. Many land areas had sunk during fracturing of the Earth's crust. Others had risen. Oceans were higher. Some seas drained, and others formed. One particular landmass that sunk was the Mediterranean basin, formerly an elevated valley consisting of lakes prior to its disruption and submergence. The Strait of Gibraltar did not exist at that time. Eventually, after a long period of time, the collapsed sky conditions returned to normal. The combined conditions of enforced, degraded tribal living, a wandering, nomadic existence, and harsh planetary changes caused long-term retardation in man's progress for the for the decades. Memories of the cataclysm were explained as a great war in heaven between the departed gods, and eventually was preserved in many ancient myths. As such, mankind existed and multiplied under these conditions for nearly 1,000 years. Then the elder gods returned to Earth. Some accounts say in fiery flying machines, and re-established knowledge among men on a global basis. Once more, they taught men how to read, write, construct cities, build ships, map-making, agriculture, metallurgy, astronomy, math, medicine, divination, magic, the techniques of war, or in other words, they helped restore civilization. However, their main agenda was to re-corrupt the surviving seed of men to ensure that the Redeemer would not be born here on this planet. Idolatry and priestcrafts were reintroduced under the auspices of religion. Once again, giants began to be born from the fair daughters of men. Legends speak of the bellies of women rupturing during childbirth because of the size of the giant infants. Even into the Middle Ages, women feared childbirth because of the possibility of having giant offspring through ancestral lines being corrupted generations before. Married and pregnant women carried talismans to ward off this evil. Different cultures and different times called the gods by various different names. The first name given below is the earlier name, and the second name is the name known in later times to the same cultures. In Judaic traditions, they were called Nephilim, or Watchers. In Iranian legends, they were the Ahuras, or Devas. In Sumero-Akkadian legends, they were the Anunnaki, or the Anunnaki. And in Assyro-Babylonian legends, they were the Edimmu. Later cultures of the Roman and Greek empires referred to them as elder gods, or titans. These were the immortals. Some of their gigantic offspring were given the status of immortality. But most were mortal. However, they usually enjoyed a long lifespan. Most of the Olympians were immortal because they were the offspring of both male and female gods and goddesses. However, some mated with mortal men and women and produced mortal Olympians. Kings, who are descendants of partnerships between humans and the gods, are considered either divine or part demon or demigods. The elder gods and their giant offspring, along with mankind, began to rebuild some megalithic cities, namely Tiahuanaco in Bolivia, and to construct new towns and megalithic stone cities and structures all over the world. By 8000 BC, the first new town, called Jericho, was constructed. And other megalithic cities, such as Baalbek and the original Jerusalem in the Middle East, soon followed, as did Babylon and Byblos. These cities were all built and occupied by giants. In fact, it is mentioned in the Zohar that King Nimrod was a giant. Readers are referred back to the chapter The Giants for a broad overview of their dispersal and occupation of this planet. The ancient Egyptians claimed they inherited their advanced culture from a race of elder gods who lived during the previous age known to them as Zeptepi, or the first time. They knew the elder gods to be members of a race of fallen angels who founded ancient Egypt. Egypt, apparently, was spared the brunt of the cataclysm. The gods returned to the colonizers and helped them build the Giza temple complex near the Sphinx. It is claimed that they built pyramids in the area, yet undiscovered, lying buried in the sands. Temple priests initially maintained the Hall of Records until schools of learning were built that housed copies of the texts and maps contained therein. Because of access to the Hall of Records that contained important knowledge, vital to civilizations, Egypt quickly became the most advanced, learned, and powerful empire for thousands of years. Erich von Däniken states the following in his book Gods from Outer Space. The Sumerians had one single concept for the universe, Anki, which can be roughly translated as heaven and earth. Their myths tell of gods who drove through the sky in barks and fire ships, descended from the stars, fertilized their ancestors, and then returned to the stars again. The Sumerian pantheon, the shrine of the gods, was animated by a group of beings who possessed fairly recognizable human shape, but appear to have been superhuman, indeed immortal. But the Sumerian texts do not refer to their gods with vague imprecision. They say quite clearly that the people had once seen them with their own eyes. Their sages were convinced that they had known the gods who completed the work of instruction. We can read in the Sumerian texts how everything happened. The gods gave them writing. They gave them instructions for making metal and taught them how to cultivate barley. We should also note that according to Sumerian records, the first men are supposed to have resulted from the interbreeding of gods and the children of earth. As your authors have stated before, this is probably what the Anunnaki told men in order to hold them in willing submission, and this is the reason for so many similar legends as to the origin of mankind, as stated in Gods from Outer Space. I continue to quote, Tibetan and Hindus call the universe the mother of the terrestrial race. The natives of Malekula state that the first race of men consisted of descendants of the sons of heaven. The Red Indians say that they are the descendants of the Thunderbird. The Incas believe they descended from the sons of the sun. The Rapa Nui trace their origin back to the birdmen. The Mayas are supposed to be children of the Pleiades. The Teutons claim their forefathers came with the flying Wanen. The Indians believe they descend from Indra, Gurkha, or Bhima, all three of whom drove through the heavens in fire ships. The South Sea Islanders say they descend from the god of heaven, Tangalau, who came down from heaven in an enormous gleaming egg. Continuing on with von Däniken, he further writes, on one of the tablets translated by the Sumerologist S. N. Kramer, we read, in order to destroy the seed of mankind, the decision of the Council of the Gods is proclaimed, according to the commanding words of An and Enlil. Their dominion shall come to an end. It is in this text, by the gods' own admission, their purpose for coming to this planet was to corrupt the seed of men that will end their dominion. It would end the dominion of this planet if the Redeemer couldn't be born and fulfill God's promise to the upper Adam. The Redeemer had to come through uncorrupted, pure Adamic bloodline. The Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh is even seen through slanted eyes. Gilgamesh was the fifth Sumerian king of Uruk. He is described in the epic as being two-thirds god and one-third human, and is also described as being a giant. The giant's text of the Dead Sea Scrolls mentioned Gilgamesh twice. In this epic, the creation of man is credited to the workings of the Anunnaki. Thus, as said before, those teachings kept men in willful submission. Astonishingly, the Sumerian king records of ancient Mesopotamia, preserved in cuneiform script called the Weld Blundell Prism, gives accounts of rulers going back nearly half a million years. Yet even more amazing is that each king is said to have ruled for 20 or 30,000 years. King List, WB 444, reveals, "When the kingship came down from the skies, the kingship was in Eridu. He reigned 28,000 years. Alagar reigned 36,000 years. Two kings each ruled for 64,000 years." And so the list goes on, one account after another of incredible reigns. After the deluge of 9600, 9500 BC, the reigns of the kings come down dramatically to just 15 years. Chinese records refer to an age when heavenly emperors ruled here on the earth. 13 emperors are each said to have reigns of 18,000 years. Here again, their records insist this kingship arrived from the skies, a kingship that was to last for nearly 500,000 years. Almost every culture of size has oral traditions of when sky rulers reigned on this planet for thousands of years. There have been many explanations for the fantastic number of years the kings each reigned. We believe that these records are further evidence of the elder gods' occupation of this planet, beginning many thousands of years ago. Kinship literally arrived here from the skies, established colonies, built cities, coexisted with men, and corrupted their bloodlines. They were immortal beings, so that is why they could rule for thousands of years. After the 9600, 9500 BC cataclysm, mortals resumed the rule of some of these ancient cities that were rebuilt, and consequently their reigns were much shorter. Here is an interesting statement found in the appendix section under History of the Jews, Book 5, as found in the book The New Complete Works of Josephus, that reads as follows. Their tradition is that the Jews ran away from the Isle of Crete and settled themselves on the coast of Libya, and this at the time when Saturn was driven out of his kingdom by the power of Jupiter. Josephus continues, "But because their priests, the Jewish priests, when they play on the pipe and the timbrels, wear ivory round their head, and a golden vine had been found in their temple, some had thought that they worshipped our father Bacchus, the conqueror of the East, whereas the ceremonies of the Jews do not all agree with those of Bacchus, for he appointed rites that were of a jovial nature and fit for festivals, while the practices of the Jews are absurd and sordid." In another section he writes, "And indeed Alexander Polyhistor gives his attestation to what I hear say, who speaks thus, Cleodemus the prophet, who was also called Malchus, who wrote a history of the Jews in agreement with the history of Moses, their lawgiver, relates that there were many sons born to Abraham by Keturah. Nay, he names three of them, Afer, and Surim, and Japhran. And from Surim was the land of Assyria dominated, and that from the other two, Afer and Japhran, the country of Africa took its name, because these men were reinforcements to Hercules, a giant son of Zeus or Jupiter, when he fought against Libya and Antaeus, and that Hercules married Afra's daughter, and of her he begat a son, Diodorus, and that Sophon was his son, and from that barbarous people called Sophacians were dominated." Words in parentheses in bold type are added. These writings simply imply Saturn, Jupiter, Bacchus, and Hercules were indeed historical figures that were recognized as gods, and Bacchus was recognized as their father or creator. Hercules, a giant son of Zeus, and Alcmene were apparently married to Aphir's daughter, Abraham's granddaughter, corrupting that branch of Abraham's offspring. After the cataclysm, the elder gods stayed only long enough to guarantee the corruption of the bloodlines and to reestablish civilization. Then they departed because they hated the harsh living conditions in the New Age, having preferred the paradise of the Golden Age. Life was simply too hard here and not to their liking. They reasoned this earth was just a little remote, insignificant planet on the edge of the Milky Way, devastated by a cataclysm. The climate was now harsh, with fierce storms, practically unfit for habitation, and all the seed of the survivors had been corrupted for generations. Before departing, they left their giant offspring in charge that reigned supreme for many generations. And furthermore, they concluded that their mission here was complete. The Redeemer would not come to this planet. They left to find other worlds to corrupt their seed in like matter, to prevent the Redeemer from being born on that particular planet. The billions of Nephilim were doing this to every planet they could find in the temporal universe that had human life forms in order to prevent the Redeemer being born on that creation. Tactics of this type, in fact, if successful, would have guaranteed their dominion over planets in this universe in which to call home. Of course, this error in judgment resulted in the eventual coming of the Redeemer to this planet. Why did he choose this little obscure planet? Some say the Redeemer came to this planet because it probably was the most wicked of all the inhabited planets. Have you thought that there may be another, even more compelling logic? After all, the efforts from those outside the family of Adam and Eve to corrupt and destroy his plan, the evidence seems to indicate that he may have chosen Earth as the birthplace of the Savior because it was the most unlikely place. The mystical union of the spirit Earth with the temporal Earth, the flood of Deucalion, occurred in a quiet manner, without fanfare, unannounced and unnoticed. It is rather difficult to pinpoint the exact date this event occurred, but we estimate that it may have occurred around 4800 BC. This date, of course, will shock Bible scholars, who place the date of the flood of Noah much later, of about 2400 to 2300 BC. However, they have lacked the knowledge of the union of the two earths, the knowledge of which dramatically clarifies the entire history of the earth. Noah and his entourage arrived in an isolated region and remained in that area a while before journeying to Lower Sumer, later called Chaldea, which occupied the same plains of Shinar. A branch of his family, some descendants of Ham and his daughter, Aegyptis, migrated into Egyptian lands. In the book Atlantis, Mother of Empires, by Robert B. Stacy Judd, the following is stated. There is actual historical evidence that a superior race of people invaded Egypt from the east or southeast prior to 4500 BC. They brought with them a civilization superior to the African and appear to have introduced wheat, barley, the sheep, the art of writing, a superior kind of brick-making. They settled in the Nile Valley and Delta. Delta regions are marshlands full of reeds and rushes, such as was and still is a description of Lower Mesopotamia and the regions near the Euphrates, which includes the Nile Valley. Such was the area that Aegyptus first discovered and later settled. From the east would have been from the direction of the Akkadian civilization, who later became known as the Chaldeans. In a short time after arriving on this earth, Noah and his people encountered another race of people not related in any way. What a surprise! encounter that must have been. Believe it or not, the Zohar describes such an encounter. The account goes as follows. The two men went on and sat down by a cleft in the rock and were amazed to see a man suddenly emerge from it. "Who art thou?" the two men asked. "I belong to the denizens of Arka," he answered. "Are there human beings there?" they asked. "Yes," he answered, "and they sow and reap. Some of them are of a strange appearance, different from my own, and the reason I ascend to you is to learn from you the name of the earth wherein ye dwell." "This earth is called Erez," answered the two men. The man thereupon returned to his place, leaving them astonished. From the book of the angel Reziah, Arka, Areka, is the name of the spirit earth that exists in the spiritual universe of Yetzirah, the universe of formation. According to the book, the lowest earth, temporal earth, is named Erez, or Aretz, located in the universe of making, the physical universe, called Asiyah. The book of the angel Reziel identifies the names of the two earths, and the Hebrew book of the dead identifies the location of each earth. The unrelated people who had contact with Noah's family regarded them as divine gods, being similar to the elder gods. Like the elder gods, they had arrived in a great flying ship, the Ark of Millions of Years, which came from another place in the heavens, having sailed across the cosmic sea. To the children of this planet, they were indeed gods. No amount of explanation from Noah would have convinced them otherwise. They admired their great knowledge and longevity. Kings welcomed and bestowed honors fit for gods upon them. Pharaohs acknowledged their divinity and thereafter referred to them as the divine seed. As such, in the Babylonian mysteries, Noah was called Diphius, or twice-born god, because he had lived in two worlds, and was commemorated as a god with two heads looking in opposite directions, one toward each world. It is generally accepted in Jewish tradition that Shem became king of Salem, and was known in religious circles as the great high priest Melchizedek. However, another account is found in the book of Enoch the prophet as follows. "Behold the wife of Ner, Noah's brother, whose name was Sophonim, being made sterile and never having at any time given birth to a child by Ner. Sophonim was in the time of her old age and in the day of her death. She conceived in her womb. But Ner the priest had not slept with her from the day that the Lord had appointed him to conduct the liturgy in front of the face of the people. When Sophonim saw her pregnancy, she was ashamed and embarrassed, and she hid herself during all the days until she gave birth. Not one of the people knew about it. When 282 days had been completed, and the day of the birth began to approach, Ner remembered his wife. He called her to himself in his house, so that he might converse with her. Sophonim came to Ner, her husband, and behold, she was pregnant, and the day appointed for giving birth was drawing near. Ner saw her, and became very ashamed. He said to her, 'What is this thou hast done, O wife? Why have you disgraced me in front of the face of the people? Now depart from me and go where you began this disgrace of your womb, that I might not defile my hand on account of you and sin in the face of you.' And it came to pass that when Ner had spoken to his wife, Sophonim, that Sophonim fell down at Ner's feet, and died. The archangel Gabriel appeared to Nir and said to him, "Do not think that your wife Sophonim has died because of your error. But this child, which is to be born of her, is a righteous fruit, and one whom I shall receive into paradise, so that you will not be the father of a gift of God." When they had gone out toward the grave, a child came out from the dead Sophonim and sat on the bed at her side. Noah and Nir came in to bury Sophonim, and they saw the child sitting beside the dead Sophonim, wiping his clothing. Noah and Nir were very terrified with great fear, because the child was fully developed physically. He spoke with his lips and blessed the Lord. Noah and Nir looked at him closely, saying, "This is from the Lord, my brother." And behold, the badge of priesthood was upon his chest, and it was glorious in appearance. Noah said to Nir, "Behold, God is renewing the priesthood from blood related to us, just as he pleases." Noah and Nir hurried and washed the child. They dressed him in garments of the priesthood, and they gave him bread to eat, and he ate. And they called him Melchizedek. The Lord heeded Nir, and appeared to him in a night vision. And he said to him, "I, in a short while, will send my archangel Gabriel, and he will take the child and put him in the paradise of Eden. He will not perish along with those who must perish. As I have revealed it, Melchizedek will be my priest to all holy priests. I will sanctify him and will establish him, so that he will be the head of all priests of the future. And behold, Melchizedek will be the head of priests in another generation. I know that great confusion has come, and in confusion this generation will come to an end, and everyone will perish, except that Noah, my brother, will be preserved for procreation. From his tribe there will arise numerous people, and Melchizedek will become the head of priests, reigning over a royal people who serve you, O Lord." As you can see, Melchizedek was born of a virgin mother. He was taken from the earth and placed in the protective custody of the Garden of Eden until 11 years after the flood. He was returned to the earth by the angel Gabriel and assigned to the duty of guarding the tomb of Adam, who was reburied by Noah after the floodwaters had subsided, as his body and that of Eve were carried upon the ark, so as not to be washed away in the flood. He maintains his status as high priest even unto the days of Abraham. He remained the king of Salem, and was described in the book of Hebrews as the one who bestowed the priesthood upon Jesus at another time. We do not know what happened to him after the mission of Jesus was completed. We do know he was described in Hebrews as being without beginning of days or end of years. What language did Noah speak? According to the book of Moses, chapter 6, he would have spoken the pure Adamic language of God, no longer existent. This language, in its pure form, was far superior to any known tongue in existence. It is possible that the Adamic language was an early form of Hebrew that eventually blended with the ancient Akkadian language to later emerge as the archaic Hebrew dialect. Both languages are dead. The Akkadian language was replaced by Aramaic, and the archaic Hebrew language was revived in the 1880s as modern Hebrew. In the British Museum pamphlet, The Babylonian Legend of the Flood, the following statement is made: Akkadian is a Semitic language cognate to Hebrew, Arabic, Assyrian, and Babylonian. Sumerian, on the other hand, is an unclassified language which has so far resisted all attempts to relate it to any known living or dead language. All nations who are descendants of Shem, son of Noah, are the Semites, a modern designation taken from the Hebrew scriptures. An ancient Akkadian legend depicts their ancestor, a king named Zethusus sailing a ship to Armenia after the great flood, and his son Zerban becoming supreme king of the region. Old Chaldean texts also name their primogenitor as a mighty prince named Zerban.
Please insert The Brave New World number 2.